Hello, this is Alex Zavistovich. Last year, the National Edgar Allan Poe Theater was invited by the Provincetown Tennessee Williams Theater Festival to adapt for the stage an early and little-known story by Williams, The Eye That Saw Death. With themes echoing Poe's story, The Telltale Heart, the resulting production was a hit of the festival. The Poe Theater has been invited back to Provincetown this year to mount a whole new production. We'll keep you all up to date as we get closer to our performances. In the meantime, enjoy this theatrically enhanced reading of The Eye That Saw Death, performed by the Poe Theater's own Jennifer Restak, with sound design by Alex Zavistovich.
The disease which had afflicted my eyes since childhood was of a most strange and inexplicable nature. Indeed, to the many oculists whom I had consulted from time to time, it had presented an almost complete and inscrutable mystery. None other like it, they declared, had ever been recorded. All the many experimental treatments which they had subjected me to had accomplished nothing. Slowly, relentlessly, the dread disease destroyed my sight. Its heinous process was a gradual atrophying or stiffening of the eyeballs. By my 30th birthday, it had so far advanced that I was forced to abandon work at my office. Since I had tried all the well-known oculists of the country, there seemed nothing more to be done but to accept with fortitude the apparently inevitable. And so I placed my financial affairs in the hands of a competent attorney, stacked my library with raised print books, studied the geography of my small suburban home, counted its steps, and in other ways prepared myself for the relentlessly enveloping darkness. Just at this time, when I had given up the apparently useless fight and had resigned myself to a life of blindness, a celebrated European oculist entered the country to make a tour of it, giving lectures upon some new field of his profession, which he had done much to develop. He was the most progressive young oculist of Europe, and although he was known to be somewhat erratic in temperament, he held the confidence and odd respect of his fellows. He had received wide publicity through the almost miraculous operations he had performed in restoring sight to the blind. Somehow, probably through one of the several oculists whom I had consulted in New York, he heard of my case. And shortly after his arrival in the country, I received a letter from him saying that if I would come to New York for an examination, he might find it possible to save me from blindness by some operation which had never been attempted before, but which he believed might be successfully performed. With that surge of hope which man, however often he is discouraged, seems always able to feel, I hastened to New York and waited 2 months in a hotel until the completion of the doctor's tour. When on the day of his return, I presented myself at his improvised office, he received me eagerly, I might almost say, excitedly.
My dear,
he said with effusive cordiality,
you may give me the opportunity of gratifying a lifelong ambition.
He thrust me immediately into a chair, and for the next hour, my eyes were subjected to a thorough examination in which the doctor apparently took as intense and vital interest as I. When it was concluded, he drew up his chair and began to speak. The first time, except for his frequent ahs, his voice was almost shaking with excitement.
It is just as I hoped,
he said.
The optical nerves of your left eye may not have been affected. That means I may be able to give you back your sight. At last I can perform that operation which I have so long planned and studied. My dear, you may prove of tremendous value to medical science. Listen, this is what I propose to do. For a long time, I have been experimenting with animals in a form of optical surgery which may be called, non-technically, eye transplantation. That is, I take, for instance, two guinea pigs, remove from each an eye, place in the eye socket of one guinea pig the eye of the other. In practically every case, the transplanted eye and the optical nerves have grown together, conformed, and eventually the guinea pig was able to see with that eye. Now, in anticipation of this operation, which must be performed immediately, if at all, I have secured a number of human eyes.
Suddenly, divining, with insufferable horror and revulsion, the project that was being laid before me, I jumped up from the chair. "No!" I screamed, almost choking. "It is utterly unthinkable! How can you suggest such a thing? It is too horrible! Too horrible! Better blindness than that!" We stood facing each other for a moment. I could only see the outline of his face, but I knew his fury at me by the rush of his breath. I turned away and stumbled across the room and groped along the wall for the door. The very room had become loathsome to me. But before I could find my way out, he rushed towards me.
"You fool. Do you think I will let a little silly squeamishness stand in the way of science?"
He caught me around the waist in a grip of tremendous strength. I struggled desperately to get away. But in his hands, a strange weakness had come over me. I noticed that he was pressing his fist hard into the flesh below my heart. My struggles were useless. As if I were a child, he dragged me across the room to a table, muffling my mouth with one hand. He caught up a little bottle and pressed its cold mouth, from which deadly fumes arose, against my nostrils. After a minute more of frantic struggle against his iron-like arms, consciousness fell away from me, and I was completely in the power of this inhumanly cold-blooded scientist. When the effects of the anesthetic wore off and sentience gradually reestablished itself, I found myself between the stiff, cold sheets of a hospital bed. I became aware shortly of a terrible throbbing in my head, which made me groan with anguish. A nurse stepped quickly to my side. Still uncomprehending, I tried to speak to her to ask what had happened to me. But I discovered that my jaws were tightly clamped together by the bandages which covered my head. The nurse, who was standing beside the bed, caught my hand as I lifted it to loosen the bandages. She told me that the doctor had said I must not speak, must not move my head, and unless I obeyed, I would have to be strapped to the bed. And so for weeks I lay there in forced silence, while I was racked with the most excruciating pain. It was more mental than physical, for I knew what had been done to me. Far more terrible than the tearing pain within my head was the pain of that knowledge of what had been done to me. The knowledge that in my head was the eye of a dead man. An eye that should be cold and glazed with death in a corpse beneath the ground. Oh, the knowledge of that. All through the long, fiery days it haunted me. And at night, when finally I could sleep, I dreamed of it. Fantastic, hideous dreams a dead man arising from his grave, coming to me, one eye missing from his ghastly visage and demanding that which had been stolen from him be returned. I would awake, my scream of terror muffled by the bandages, and find that what seemed too awful to be true was true. The eye. Sometimes I was convulsed with horror. Every day, the doctor came, bent over my bed and examined his fiendish work. How my hands, writhing beneath the covers, longed to grab his throat and to choke the life from him. Slowly, lusting in the crackle of his bones between them. But well I knew the futility of attempting such a thing. I would only be thrust down by that savage strength of his and strapped to the bed.
Hysteria,
he would explain to the nurse. Yes, he was clever, beastly clever. I realized now that I was powerless to ever avenge myself upon him for his ruthless mutilation and torment of me. Useless to tell that I had been operated upon under compulsion, no one would believe it. He would say that it was only a hallucination I had suffered while under the anesthetic. Or he would say that I was temporarily deranged from the shock of the operation. He would return to his country covered with glory. Glory that he had bought at the price of his honor and all his claim to decent manhood. But no one knew except him and me. I was powerless to impugn him, and he, apparently, had no conscience to give him trouble. It was plain after the first few weeks that the operation was a success. He left every morning more elated than before. The eye and the optical nerves were growing together as he had hoped. Soon, he told me each time, I would be able to see. And he was right. Every morning, my bed was moved to the window, and I was told to look. Day after day, as this was repeated, the unrelieved wall of black seemed to grow lighter, till finally it was a gray, and I could see the sun. A smudge of white in the sky. In his fervor, the doctor would grab my wrists and squeeze them. Once, driven to uncontrollable fury by this, I raised my fist and struck him. Long afterwards, I treasured the remembrance of that hard, fury-driven blow. Perhaps he, too, will remember it as he lies on his deathbed, ready to account for his mortal life. Sight was returning to me. Soon I would be able to leave the hospital, return to my home, take up my promising career again, which had been so tragically interrupted. But would I not always be haunted? Perhaps you may think me unduly sensitive. Squeamish, as he said, about the thing, but you cannot comprehend the horror of it. I have written enough of those months in the hospital, painful to recall. Let me pass over them now, to the day of my release, when the slow process of confirmation between eye and optical nerves had been completed, and the sight of the eye was marvelously near to perfect. By this time, I had to some degree reconciled myself to the thing, although I still had frequent attacks of shuddering. On that day of my release, I dared to look at myself in the mirror for the first time, and what I saw was even worse than I expected. there was between my old and new eye, the most striking and hideous contrast. The old one, now completely blind, was brown and had a dull and glazed appearance. The other one, however, was vivid blue, probably once of singular beauty, but now it was made indescribably hideous by the dilation of the eyeball. This dilation gave it an expression such as is seen in the eyes of a person stricken with some sudden and terrible physical agony. It was an expression of utmost terror. How, I wondered, could anyone face me hereafter without a shudder of revulsion? And how could I ever accustom myself to this? Before leaving the hospital, I had a pair of shaded glasses brought to me. I never removed them thereafter except in the privacy of my inner office or my bedroom. After my return to my home, I plunged into business more furiously than ever before, seeking to drive from my mind memory of the frightful ordeal I had undergone. I accepted eagerly all the invitations of my sympathetic friends who were rejoicing over the recovery of my sight. They did not know how I had recovered it, and I endeavored to be around people as much as possible. For the moment I was alone, in would creep those haunting, sickening horrors. In order to sleep at night, I was forced to take opiates. It was a number of months before my nerves were sufficiently steadied to sleep without them. And now I arrive at the entrance into my life of that which drove me near to madness. Indeed, I marvel that even now, after many years, I am able to write of it so calmly. I cannot say exactly at what time it first came. Perhaps the first night that I slept without taking drugs. Anyway, this is what happened. I had been sleeping soundly, dreamlessly, throughout the earlier part of the night, but when the hours before morning came, when the tide of sleep begins to ebb, the black curtains around me, the black curtains of sleep, were suddenly, violently torn away, and there was revealed to me, what was it? A chaotic blur, fantastically twisted flame, strange, indefinable shapes, a convulsion, a vivid, startling color. I watched it, fascinated for a moment, but with a tingling of strange dread. I knew that it was something of horror, and yet I knew not why it was horrible. Like a child who sees a snake for the first time and fears it without knowing why. But after I had watched it for a moment thus, another thing entered the picture, and my heart was clutched by an icy hand. For this was a shape unearthly. No human face was that which stretched forth, leering at me through the flames. Upon it, by the leaping flames, was thrown a lurid blush, a blush of purple and red. Its shape was that of a skull. Yes, a fleshless skull. But within it, there were eyes, huge, black, bulging eyes, glowing with the firelight, and some wild demon passion. From the mouth, stretched wide with hideous screaming unheard by my ears, there coiled forth a long black tongue. Its arms were stretched before it, and its hands, claw-like, seemed ready to dig into human flesh for which it lusted. I try to describe it, but I fail. There are no words, not in any earthly language, with which to portray this thing. I'm sorry, I can't say. Indeed, if I were the most skillful artist equipped with the utmost variety of paints and instruments, I would find myself utterly incapable of reproducing with them any semblance of this hideous apparition. Only the mere physical aspects of it can I describe. I am unable to put into words that intense, vibrant, incorporeal something which gave it that awful animation. But let me go on within the feeble power of words. It was crouching, this monstrous creature, like a beast ready to leap upon its prey. Its lips were drawn back to reveal terrible, tusk-like teeth. The interior of its mouth, from which its black tongue coiled like a serpent, was a flaming scarlet. The figure of the thing was very indistinct, enveloped as it was in the fire which surged over the entire picture. It was like the pit of an erupting volcano, fiery, seething, from which this demon was rising. Amid this terrific maelstrom of fire, I could see, although my attention was riveted the whole time upon that central demon thing, black faces like those of human beings, twisted into aspects of horrible agony. Hands, too, black as coals, groped stiffly up, and I seemed almost to hear the dreadful cries of anguish. Like all nightmares or apparitions of such extreme terror, this lasted no more than a few seconds. It was only the flashing of a picture, and the shock of it was so great that it awakened me almost immediately. The next instant, I found myself in my bed, my whole body shuddering convulsively. I was then completely awake. Yet it seemed, as I looked into the darkness over me, that the terrible demon was still before me. It was bent over my bed. It was reaching for my throat. I could see the glare of the flames behind him still, and in them, the blackened faces. It was then, when I had awakened and yet still saw the frightful apparition, that I voiced that cry of terror which my neighbor informed me had caused him to jump from his bed. The moment in which I uttered that shriek was the most terrible moment of my whole life. I lay transfixed, smothered with terror, unable to move, staring helplessly up into that ghastly, lurid face which seemed to be bending over me and shrinking back like a trapped rabbit from those claws which seemed about to rend my body. If it had lasted a moment longer, I am sure that my heart would have ceased to beat. However, thanks to God, the full intensity was of very brief duration. Hardly had I uttered the shriek than the vision began slowly to fade away. The glare of flames died out. The hideous face sunk reluctantly into blackness, as if unseen hands were dragging it away from me. I lay still after its disappearance for some minutes, gasping for breath and struggling to free myself from the physical paralysis which had taken hold of me. Any minute, I thought, the demon might escape its captor and rush again upon me. Minutes passed, though, and the room remained black and empty. Gradually, my terror subsided, and at length I was able to crawl from the bed and to stumble across the room. I groped wildly along the wall for the electric light switch, expecting momentarily to feel sharp claws sink into my neck. Finally, my trembling fingers came upon the button. I pressed it and whirled around, my arms raised in front of me to ward off an attack. However, the room, flooded with bright light, was empty of any malign presence. I sank to the floor beside the light switch, completely exhausted. Only by the utmost effort was I able to hold back those hysterical sobs which rose in my throat. When I had finally mastered myself, I got to my feet again, stumbled to the window and raised it, then to the door and swung it open. When I had done this, thus providing convenient exits in case the phantom should reappear, I sat down in the chair, drawn close to the window, and with my dressing gown wrapped around me and the cold night wind sweeping over me, I tried to calm myself, to persuade myself that what I had experienced was nothing more than an extraordinarily terrible nightmare. I sat there all night, and when dawn came, I was still shuddering from more than cold. The following day, my nerves were completely shattered as a result of my terrible experience of the night. I found it impossible to dismiss from my mind thought of that terrible nightmare. Or was it merely a nightmare? I had been unable to convince myself that it was only that. Nightmares are created from the imagination. It seemed incredible that my imagination, which had never been particularly acute, could have created such a fantastic, weird, unearthly, horrible apparition as that which had appeared to me last night. And then, too, nightmares are confined to sleep. I had seen that apparition last night for fully a minute with undiminished vividity after I had awakened. But if it were not a nightmare, what else could it be? The question made me shudder. Even in the briskly industrious atmosphere of my office, my thoughts repeatedly turned to that question. The white papers on my desk seemed to reflect a hideous, flame-lit face. The glare of fire and the agony-distorted faces burnt to blackness of human beings. When a friend who had come up behind me clasped my shoulder, I started in remembrance of that claw-like hand which had stretched towards me. Nothing had ever so greatly shaken me as had this experience of the night. That evening, as I sat in the interurban car carrying me to my suburban home, I could not find the usual relaxation and interest in reading the news of the day. The affairs of the world seemed colorless, mundane. My attention kept slipping away from the printed pages upon which I had been trying to fasten it. One thought kept recurring in my mind, giving me torment. Suppose it should come back. That was the thought. I jerked my head as if to fling the harrowing thought from me, but it clung pertinaciously. I turned my head to the window and looked out at the darkening country flowing past. Through the trees and over a lighted farmhouse, a monstrous flame-lit face was peering. It was the face that I had seen over my bed. Suppose tonight I should see it again. That night as I got into bed, I scorned and derided myself for the foolish, unwomanly fear that I felt. I resolved not to be troubled longer by what, as I told myself, had been only a dream brought on by the agitated condition of my nerves. Only a dream, nothing more. And yet, suppose it should come back. That night, it did come back. It came exactly as it had come before. The stage upon which dream plays are enacted had been dark and empty. With the rush of a storm came on that scene of hell. Phantasmagoric flame broke through the blackness. A hideous demon uprose. The shock of it awoke me instantly as it had the night before. But my terror as I opened my eyes to find that the demon was by my bed again surpassed even that of the previous night. All breath left my body. I felt that it was choking me. I writhed upon the bed, striving to tear those fingers from my throat. But they only tightened. The lurid face was pressed against my own. It was fortunate that I rolled to the edge of the bed and fell off of it. The fall saved me from succumbing completely to an hysteria of terror. There was a lamp positioned not far from this side of the bed from which I had fallen. Arising to my feet, I clambered towards this lamp. My arms, seeking it wildly in the dark, struck it to the floor. I fell down upon it, jerking the string. As on the night before, light dispelled the apparition, and the room was just as it had been before I retired. My terror had somehow, in its intensity, incited me to an unnatural strength and quickness. I lifted the lamp up as I sprang to my feet without feeling the weight of it. With one arm, I snatched up my clothes. I rushed into the hall, down the stairs, with the gigantic torch still in my hand, and modesty did not stop me from rushing out of the street door in my nightshirt. A night watchman was pacing up the street and passing my house at the time. He caught me by the shoulder. I do not know what it was that I jabbered wildly to him, but it must have convinced him that I had gone mad. He dragged me back into my house and helped me into my clothes. By this time, I had recovered some composure. The night watchman was anxious to get me off his hands, and so he accepted my explanation that I had been sleepwalking. When finally I had gotten him out of the house, I put on my own overcoat and hat, my body still shaking as with palsy, and I spent the remainder of the night waiting for the morning train to the city. The station master, seeing my face, probably said to himself that if a murder had been committed in the neighborhood that night, he knew who had done it. I arrived in the city several hours in advance of the usual time, and the gray of early morning was penetrated only by the street lamps and the all-night electric signs. My intention, still vaguely formulated, I had been too confused, too appalled to think clearly, was to go to my doctor and tell the story to him. Yet I scarcely hoped that he could do anything for me. Probably he would only say something about the shock of the recent operation, upset nerves, and would give me a prescription of pills. That would do no good. But something had to be done. I could be haunted no longer by this horrible apparition, or I would go mad. Perhaps I was mad. Certainly I had gone through enough to shatter the mind of any man. The awfulness of that slow, creeping blindness. The hideousness of that operation which had given me back sight. And now, this harrowing apparition that haunted me. Oh, it was enough to drive me mad. With haste that must have appeared frenzied to the few early pedestrians who passed me, I walked, heedless of direction, through the city streets. The doctor's offices were still unopened. It was useless for me to go to my own office. Only by this rapid walking could I relieve the terrific strainedness of my nerves. I must have walked for hours through the thickening streets, unaware of where I went, unaware of anything around me, until I must have been led by more than mere chance. I turned down a side street through which I had not passed before. As I turned into it, my attention was caught almost forcibly by an immense painted eye which protruded from the side of one of the smaller buildings. That eye, staring unblinkingly at me through the gray fog of morning, shot into my brain a thought which astounded and appalled me and seemed to turn my blood to ice. Could there not be some connection between this apparition that haunted me and the eye? The eye that was not mine in my head. That was the question which transfixed me. I looked again at the huge eye, Beneath it was printed the name of an oculist. I walked on as unsteadily as a drunkard to the door, and I turned into it. The oculist was one whom I had consulted before, and he was familiar with my case. His office hours had not commenced, but I clambered up the stairs, threw open the glazed door, and entered. This thought which had taken possession of me, which had driven me suddenly here, made me almost frantic. I leaned against the door and gasped for breath. My hand was clasped over that eye which had again become an insufferable agony. The doctor, startled from some occupation at his desk by my violent entrance, now recognized me despite my wild and changed appearance. He got up from his desk and clasped my shoulders.
"What is the matter with you?"
he asked gently. Calmed somewhat by his firm clasp and kindly voice, I sank down into a chair. "Doctor," I said, "I'm nearly mad, or I am mad. This eye is driving me mad. For 2 nights I have seen an apparition, frightful, more frightful than I can tell you. It occurred to me just now that it might be, that it is this eye of a dead man." I looked up into his face, expecting to see that placating smile of disbelief, but his face remained grave and intent. I blessed him for it.
"I will examine the eye,"
he said slowly. He uncovered a long, black, telescopic instrument placed on the table before me, adjusted the lens at one end to fit against my eye, and seated himself at the other end. For a long time, he gazed intently through the instrument, shifting it slightly from time to time. When finally he raised his head again, he had upon his face the look of a man who had seen a ghost. His face was chalky white. His lips were pressed tightly together. There was a strange expression, an expression of horror in his eyes. He cleared his throat before speaking. He was greatly shaken.
"What you said is true. The apparition is in the eye. I saw it. This hideous, crouching demon. Background of fire. Black faces. Is that not it?"
I nodded, my voice gone. The doctor got up unsteadily from his chair and walked over to the window. He spoke to me from there.
"I dare not venture an explanation for this. I can only tell you this. The eye was taken from a dead criminal, executed for murder. The apparition which you've seen has been imprinted upon the eye by death."
The doctor's voice trembled and broke. I sprang to my feet.
"You mean it is what the man saw as he died? It is hell. It is death, death, death."
The doctor turned to me and shouted,
"Hush."
But there was no denial in his eyes.
"Take it from me. Take it from me,"
I screamed, falling to the floor. Many years have passed since that day. Years they have been of perpetual night, for I am now blind. My eyes are painted glass. It is true that the pleasures of the blind are few and frugal. They live apart from the world and participate little in its affairs. But I do not regret that choice I made the day I fell raving mad with horror to the floor of the oculist's office. Oh, never. Far, far better to be blind than to see with the eye that saw death.